Gosh, what an inspirational beginning to our morning. Thank you very much, Don. I can't imagine a better vision for all of us, really. Although we may not be able to be a major force, each of us, we all could be a force and a trustworthy partner for continual improvement of the health and healthcare of America, of the American people. I think it's not a bad model for. We're not as big as CMS, all of us, but we each can contribute in our own way. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Elliot Fisher. I'm from Dartmouth. And I'd like to add my welcome to you all. We have a wonderful morning ahead of us. Don has done an incredible bit of work outlining where we hope to go or where we could go with the ACO program as CMS advances its agenda. And our aim for this morning is really to help get concrete about some specific examples of places around the country that are doing this and focus, as Mark said at the introduction, on two specific areas, the notion of consumer engagement, beneficiary protection, how do we make this work from the consumer and patient's point of view, and then the second panel really about the accountability model, the financial issues. So our first panel really focuses on this challenge of engaging consumers and how we successfully partner with consumers and patients. While I do the introductions, I'd like to ask our panel members to join me up here, and I'll introduce them as they come up. And those of you who want to jump up the high step can step up there. The others who want to walk around are welcome to. So to my immediate right is Deborah Ness, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families. Deborah will be giving about a 15-minute introduction, an overview to sort of frame our discussion as a panel. And then to her immediate right and my further right is John Rother, Director of Legislation and Public Policy and Government Relations and Advocacy for the AARP, familiar to you all, I'm sure. And off far to the right in right field there is Jay Crossan, who is Associate Executive Director for the Permanente Medical Group, really running one of the large models in healthcare that we all think of as what we many of us see as the key elements of what an accountable care organization could be. So with that, I'd really like to ask Deborah to step up, make some introductory framing remarks, and then I'll get mic'd up.
Great. Hello, everybody. It's always a challenge to follow Don Berwick. I am wearing two hats today. National Partnership for Women and Families is my home, but also the National Partnership for Women and Families is the hub of something called the Campaign for Better Care, which is a coalition of consumer organizations, now more than 160 organizations strong, that is really dedicated to engaging in this discussion around how we make our delivery system work better. So the goals of ACOs, as Don just laid out, better care, better health, lower costs, are shared by consumers. There's no question about that. But we're having today's conversation because we're all excruciatingly aware of the fact that if we don't do this right, rather than consumer buy-in, we could very easily end up with consumer backlash. So I'm going to start by saying the first step we have to take is probably going to require a major paradigm shift in our healthcare system. And that is the idea that consumers and patients have to be at the table every step of the way as we try to recreate and reshape our healthcare system. That means at the policy level, that means at the design, that means at the implementation, at the governance, at the assessment, at the dissemination, and in the intermediary and education role. That may sound like a tall order, but I believe that there are already places in this country that are doing it and reaping the benefits of doing so. And I want to also make the distinction. You'll hear me use the term consumers and patients. When I say patients, I mean patients and family caregivers. But I also want to say that there is a distinction between consumer advocates and patients. And we need both at the table. They are distinct players, and they are both critically important. consumer advocates are folks who understand how to advocate, who can speak for a broad group of patients, who are sophisticated players, who can sit at the tables and go toe-to-toe with their counterpart stakeholders. Patients are folks who are seeing care up close and personal. They have information about what's working and what isn't that's not available to clinicians and staff, that only they can deliver, and it's their experience that we need to learn from. And this is not really a terribly difficult concept to understand. If you just think about the physician community, I often sit at tables with the head of the American College of Physicians or the head of the AMA, and I often hear folks say, but you know what, we need some real-world practitioners at this table too. So it's the same thing for patients and consumer advocates. Both have to be at the table. And to do that, I think we have to bust through some pretty entrenched myths in the system. First, this idea that if we just build it right, they will come. We've tried that before. It didn't work very well. Even the best of intentions, the best of ideas, if consumers aren't part of it, if they're not part of shaping it, if they don't understand it, we've learned that they can't necessarily be expected to embrace it. And I'll just give one quick example. Medical home, I know from my conversations with patients that the concepts of the medical home are extremely resonant and attractive, but find me a patient that likes the term medical home. And I think if patients had been at the table when the concept of medical home was in development, we probably never would have called it a medical home. Another thing I want to say is that education and social marketing campaigns are not the same as consumer education. It's consumer engagement. It's sort of like giving Mikey a bowl of spinach with whipped cream on top and saying, you know, eat this, you're going to like it, and hoping that he doesn't notice the green stuff underneath the whipped cream. Most important, I want to say that patient satisfaction in most people's minds today still seems like something nice, but not necessarily essential. People still don't understand that the patients themselves, when they tell us what they want and need, are actually telling us the very things that will help them adhere to and achieve the better clinical health outcomes that we want them to achieve. And there's now ample research showing that patient experience surveys, for example, are related to greater adherence, better clinical outcomes, lower malpractice risk, higher satisfaction on the part of clinicians, and more energized staff and clinicians. It's like the story Don just told us about Kevin. Kevin put his finger right on it. The things he said, I don't know how many years ago, are the things that patients still say they want the most. They want their docs to talk to each other. They want coordination. They want communication. They want to be a part of their care planning. They want to be able to anticipate. They have a lot to teach us, and those very things that they want are things that will help us get to better clinical outcomes. My fourth myth is that docs know what patients want. Often they do, but not always. And I would urge folks to take a look at some research that's being done by a woman named Karen Sapuka up at Mass General, who's actually looking at the disconnect between what patients think that doctors think that their patients want and is important to them in treatment versus what patients say that they want. And it's stunning to see how diametrically opposite sometimes those two things are. The doctors tend to focus on outcomes and survival rates. The patients tend to want to know more about side effects and risks and quality of life. And then the final myth I think we need to get through is that patients always want everything. Now, I know all about the more is better mindset and how problematic that is. But consistently, there's research showing that docs underestimate the influence that they have over their patients' decision-making. And we also know from shared decision-making research that when patients are presented with their options, they don't necessarily want everything. In fact, they're often more conservative than their docs. So we need to break through those myths if we're going to get to what I think is the number one thing we need to do to build a model that works for patients and that patients embrace, and that is we have to have consumers and patients at the table every step of the way. But there are three other things I want to touch on. One is that we have to build these models right from the get-go, so that the first taste of them isn't a sour taste that turns people off, which means we have to build them with the things in them that patients say that they want, and we have to build them in a way that really engage patients. The second thing I'm going to talk about is that we need real accountability, and that accountability needs to be to real patient-centric metrics, so that we know that at the end of the day, we are getting achievements and improvements that matter to patients. And then finally, we need to not be afraid to build in the core patient protections that patients are telling us they want. We need to build trust. And if we're building better models of care, people will come. So we cannot be afraid to build in those protections. So starting with building it right from the get-go, one of the things that I'm very concerned about is that as we build ACOs, that we keep in mind that we need to make sure they have the capacity to serve the highest risk and highest cost patients. That means that they have to be built with the capability to do comprehensive, team-based primary care, care management, care that is sometimes home and community-based. There needs to be a continuum of care. I worry that we are putting so much focus on what the right legal structure is, what the right financial mechanisms are, that we will forget that if you put together a bunch of providers who don't today know how to provide that intensive care management for those most complex patients, they're not going to somehow suddenly know it better when they're grouped together in an ACO. So what are the tools? What are the ways in which we're going to make sure that we build that primary care capacity? And for many of the patients that we have to serve if we want to bring down costs, and let's just think about it for a second, the 20% of Medicare patients that are two-thirds of the spend generally have at least five multiple chronic conditions. They tend to see, 14, 15 different doctors, make 30, 35 visits a year, have 50 different prescriptions. Sometimes they really need home-based care if we want to keep them out of the ER, if we want to keep them from being unnecessarily put in the hospital, if we want to make sure that they're not being readmitted within 30 days. How are we going to build that care continuum? We know that there are models out there, models like independence at home programs, models like the PACE program, the VA, maybe one of the most mature models of an ACO out there, made a decision back in 2006 to do home-based primary care in 140 sites. Their home care costs went up 400%. But their overall spend on those patients went down 24%, and it became the most highly rated clinical service that the VA presented. And there are examples of that over and over again. In order to build this continuum and this primary care capacity, there's going to need to be some adequate investment, as Don said, in helping practices achieve this capability. And it's going to mean probably that there needs to be some kind of risk-adjusted payment based on complexity of patients. The other thing to building these models right is making sure that we build in the right kinds of patient and family engagement right from the get-go. And I'm going to quickly run through a list and hope that we can have more conversation about these as part of the Q&A. Things like individual assessment and care planning and setting individualized goals. Things like giving people self-management support when they have chronic conditions. Things like shared decision-making tools. Things like linking people to the appropriate community-based services that can help them take advantage of the healthcare and stay healthier and live independently. And then I want to say that there are things, there are certain patient experience tools that we already have available to us, things like John Wasson's How's Your Health tool, which are ways of combining getting feedback from patients with engaging them in care and creating a tool that the patient and the physician can come together and engage around. We have these tools already at our fingertips. We need to use them. And finally, I want to talk about the idea of patient and family councils. They're being built in now to some medical homes. If any of you are familiar with this very exciting initiative in Camden, New Jersey, a Medicaid ACO initiative in Camden, New Jersey, you'll know that part of the governance of that initiative requires two voting consumers from community-based organizations as part of the process of governing that ACO, and community-based involvement in how the shared savings get put back into improving care in the communities. So engaging consumers in helping to advise and design. At the hospital level, we're seeing similar things. Patient councils, we're seeing hospitals that are saying we're no longer doing rounds in the hallway. We're going to do them in the patient room with the patients and the families at the bedside. We're going to involve patients in shift changes. There are lots of ways we can engage patients as we go along. Accountability is my second point. Accountability means strong measures to tell us whether or not we're getting where we want to go. And if there's one takeaway from my comments today, it's that at the top of the list of accountability measures should be patient experience measures. Only patients, through their experience of care and through telling us about their outcomes, their functional status, will be able to tell us whether or not ACOs are making care better for them. And that should be a sine qua non right from the beginning. We have the tools. They may not be perfect, but we can start using them. And I hope that eventually we get to a place of having a CAP survey, for example, that is specific to ACO use. You all know the other kinds of measures we need. We need measures of outcomes and functional status and coordination and cost and appropriateness of use and safety for sure. Are we also going to make sure that ACOs comport with meaningful use criteria? If we want information at the fingertips, if we want to be able to use HIT to help engage patients, we need to. And are we eventually going to get to a place where we have measures of whether or not ACOs are actually engaging patients? Are they using shared decision making? Are they doing individualized care planning? Are they linking patients to community services that can help them? Are they creating patient and family councils? Those are the kinds of measures that will tell us down the road whether we're really engaging patients. And finally, whatever measures we use, we need to, from the get-go, build the capacity to stratify those measures by race, ethnicity, language, gender, disability, socioeconomic status, because we need to be able to monitor the impact of ACOs on different populations and make sure we're addressing and reducing, not exacerbating, disparities. My final section is on patient protections, and I know this is an area that makes people utsy. CMS has been very clear that patients are not going to get locked in, which is one of the biggest fears that patients have, the loss of choice of provider or being locked into a network that's inadequate. But we are strong proponents of full transparency, which has to mean also prospective assignment. Patients have the right to know how their care is going to change. Patients have to have the right to know whether or not there are financial incentives that might affect the kinds of care recommendations that their providers make to them. And how else are we going to engage patients if they don't know? And they're not really full partners in this. And we need to make sure that patients have transparent quality and cost information if we want them to make better decisions. So full transparency, prospective assignment, I think, are critical patient protections. Flexibility, not lock-in. Adequate networks, And the creation of some kind of an ombuds or appeals process is essential. Patients need to know there's some place they can go if they feel that they're not getting the care that they should, or that their provider is recommending care that's not necessarily in their best interest. Where do they go? They need to know there's a safety valve. There's an opportunity for a second opinion. There's an opportunity, if they have a certain kind of condition, to go to the best place in the country to get the care that they need. And finally, patients deserve a return on the savings. And how that's done, there are lots of different ways. But in that Camden, New Jersey example I gave you, there's a requirement that the way that those savings are spent in the ACO have to include community input. And in a recent experience in that project, they went back to one of the areas they were serving, and they had a conversation with residents in a very large project that was responsible for much of the spend in the healthcare services. And they said, okay, we have this much money, and here's a range of things we can do with it, and what do you think we should do with it? And they voted to put a nurse practitioner in that project, which we'll see. Will probably end up being a good decision, but we'll see. But they had a say, and they own it. They own that project. So one of the areas that I get asked a lot is, how do you notify patients? If you want open, full transparency and prospective assignment, what are the best ways to notify patients? I'm going to put a three-pronged approach on the table. I think, number one, the ACO needs to notify people in a way that describes what's going to change, what the benefits are, and what the protections and responsibilities of beneficiaries are. I think that piece probably has to be standardized and approved by CMS, but I think most of the rest of it probably has to be unique to the ACO, since there's going to be a lot of variation. I think CMS has a role in notifying beneficiaries. I think they need to put out information that will lay out what are the benefits, what people can expect, what are the protections, what are the rights, what are the responsibilities. And finally, the best way for patients to learn and hear about ACOs and what it can do for them would be through individual conversation with their trusted physician. And if we want to get to that level, then we need support for the physicians so that they know how to deliver that information in an effective way and how to engage patients in that conversation. And finally, whatever we do on the notification front, I hope we focus group it and we test it with real consumers and patients, because we've learned that we speak a language that doesn't necessarily resonate outside our policy circles, and we can't keep making that mistake. So with that, I hope I've provoked some ideas for conversation. Thank you very much.
Laid out a number of challenges. Let me first come to Jay. A lot of specific requests of care organizations, essentially these ACOs to be. What are your perspectives on what we've just heard and what we should be doing?
Well, thanks, Elliot. First of all, I'd like to say, you mentioned Kaiser Permanente as an example of an ACO, and I think that's correct. Although I have to say, we actually had a meeting last week to internally to discuss whether we should say we're an ACO or not. And we haven't figured that out yet, but we did sort of decide that we'd kind of wait to see how this whole thing turns out.
Right.
And
then, that's fair.
So,
And to be fair, I would call you a proto-ACO.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
And we need a little more transparency and accountability in the context of this discussion.
Right. But the other point I wanted to make is that I'm going to talk about a little bit about engagement in an ACO, consumer engagement in an ACO. I think there's another topic here that we're going to probably need to talk about, and that's consumer engagement on ACOs. And what I mean is, what comes first? Because Deborah talked a little bit of a medical home, and we did a survey in a project that you know about of consumer attitudes towards different words, and we used medical home, and as Deborah said, people don't like it. And the comment we got back, which I remember from one participant, was, "Oh, I know what a medical home is. Yeah. First you go to a medical home, then you go to a nursing home, then you go to a funeral home. So I hope we can do a little better with ACOs.
I'm not sure.
I did want to talk a little bit about a couple of points here, and I think Deborah mentioned a couple of them, at least with respect to our own organization. And the first thing is governance, because I do think it makes a difference when you're running an organization, who's running it and what decisions they're making and whether those decisions that they're making apply to them as individuals and to their families. And that's something that we've tried to stick to. So with respect to our health plan and hospital organization, where we have a board of community individuals, these are mostly community leaders, former CEOs of corporations and the like, those individuals, except for a few who have moved subsequently out of area, those individuals receive their health care from Kaiser Permanente, as do all of our physicians and all of our employees and all of their family members. So in a sense, the people who govern our organization and the people who deliver care within our organization are all consumers. And our belief is that in the end that makes a bit of difference in terms of the direction of policies. I'd like to talk a little bit about the issue of continuity and coordination. A number of surveys, including the one I mentioned earlier, and I know Deborah had this also in the paper that she's written recently, emphasize at least the perspective of consumers about the importance of the physician-patient relationship. And in our organization, I'm talking here about Kaiser Permanente in general, but primarily in Northern California, where I have practiced and worked for over 30 years, the notion of an ACO or an organization making the investment to make sure that that relationship is strong is vitally important, particularly in a large organization that can be viewed as impersonal. So we work very hard on linking members, particularly new, we call them members, new patients to physicians. We now have 98% at any given time prevalence of 98% linkage between an individual patient and a primary care physician, mostly primary care physicians. That takes a lot of work. We do outreach at least three times over the first 60-day period. And then we have a website for every single one of our physicians, which is available to our patients so that they can access and see a picture of and read information about every one of our physicians. And they're free, of course, to move at any time from one physician to the other. The third thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is what Meredith Rosenthal called recently in an article in the New England Journal, between-visit care. And that's predicated on the notion that most health care is delivered in doctor office visits. Now, that's going to change. I think we know that. But the whole issue of engaging the consumer in self-management is often as much about what goes on in the doctor's office or in the hospital as it is what goes on between those two things. And organizing that systematically, now increasingly through the use of technology, is extremely important. So we have, with our clinical information system and the interactive capability that we've developed, the ability for our patients to see their laboratory values the instant that they're finished. So the instant that they are finished in the laboratory computer hooks up to the internet accessibility to our patients, and they see the lab results sometimes even before the physicians. Same thing with medications, not only the medications they're on, but the advice from the physician about how to use them. And we have invested highly recently in the ability of our patients to directly contact physicians by email. So we have email your doctor, and all of our members who have email capability can send a message to their physician any time of night or day. This is above and beyond emergency care and urgent care, which is available 7x24. But to get to that individual physician by email, we now have that available. The majority of answers come within 24 hours, and we're well over 90% within 48 hours. So that's a level of, I mean, you can think of that as, well, maybe this is impersonal, right? You know, email. But I'll tell you, for busy people, they just love it, the ability to connect with the physician and get an answer in a relatively short period of time to questions small and large is extremely important and connects as Deborah was saying earlier, the real needs of the person to the mind of the physician or nurse practitioner, whoever's taking care of that person. And this is doable. We do this in the rest of our lives. I mean, it's the surprise is that you can't do this, for the most part, with your own physician. And the final point I'd just like to make is about accountability. Again, as Deborah said, exceptionally important. The patient experience is the key to this. How do we do that? For our physicians, every quarter, at least 100 survey questionnaires are sent out to patients who were seen within 48 hours of the time they were seen by email or by regular mail. Now, you think about that. We have 7,000 physicians in our medical group in Northern California. That's 700,000 questionnaires sent out every 3 months. We get response rates between 40 and 75%. It has questions not just about the care of the physician, but the nurses, the staff, everything with respect to that office visit. And we use that information, that experience rating for the physician, as the key measure of reward for that physician, both in terms of recognition by peers as well as substantial reward over the career of that physician. That's a tremendous investment in time and energy, but the physicians see not only the scores, but they see the written comments from patients, and they see that every 3 months. So those are just a couple of practical issues about one organization that may or may not be an ACO, but has been around for a long time and has tried through investment and through technology to connect the consumer, in this context, the patient, more closely to the system.
That's great. Thank you. John, great to have you with us. What's your perspective from where you sit, looking across the scope of what's happening to all of us? I guess everyone in the room must be a member, right? I mean, not quite. There are a few young people up front here, but most of us are your members as well.
Welcome, members and future members. I'd like to start off by thanking you and Mark for the leadership that you brought to this whole issue. I don't think we'd be, not only wouldn't we be here today, but the whole movement wouldn't be nearly as far along without it. And I'd also like to recognize the extraordinary leadership that Don Berwick has brought to our public programs, and we are fortunate to have that. I think Deborah really covered most of the issues. I'm going to just emphasize a few. And I'm going to refer to an extraordinary article that many of you may have seen in the New Yorker by Atul Gawande just a couple of weeks ago called Hotspots. And if you haven't seen it, I certainly recommend it because it's a more in-depth treatment of some of the concepts we're talking about here. So I'd start off by saying that what we are talking about is culture change. And culture change is changes in behavior on both sides of the relationship. It's a change in behavior by the treating team, but it's also a change in behavior by the patient and the patient's family. And I want to lift up Deborah's phrase of patient and family as the key concept here. We're not just talking about one-to-one relationship, but multiple interactions. So the key to making this all work is trust. And then the goal of that trusting relationship is a change in behavior. Now, it doesn't have to be the physician. I think one of the things that we've learned in Geisinger and some of the other plans that have moved this along is that it's often other people in the office who are the keys, whether it's a nurse, a social worker, or something like a community kind of health coach who's in frequent contact with the person. Now, to change behavior, to change the behavior of the treating system and the behavior of the patient, particularly those with multiple chronic illnesses where most of the money goes, is not a matter just of information. Information is crucial. It's the basis of shared decision-making. But you're not going to get a change of behavior without the patient understanding what the benefits and risks are and why that change in behavior is a necessary or good thing. And so shared decision-making based on trust is absolutely key to this whole concept going forward. So I think that that's probably the most difficult thing. It's not so much a matter of organizational design as it is finding the right people to deliver the care. And I think that not all doctors are going to be able to do this. We have to acknowledge that to really be committed, as Don said, you have to have the right attitudes. And this is going to be a process of sorting through who can actually rise to this challenge of a relationship based on trust, a change in behavior, a team approach, and then, of course, being accountable for the results. I think there's great promise in accountable care. I think the examples we've seen in different places around the country are quite promising. But it does take kind of extraordinary leadership. It doesn't just happen because of the changing financial incentives. It does take a real commitment to the culture change. So are patients and their families ready for this? I think the people who are the most ready are the highest users of the system. They are consistently the most critical of their health care, as the people who are in the hospital a lot, those with multiple chronic diseases, those who fully experience the fragmented system that is so characteristic of much of American health care, so that they are open to this. But they need to be full partners in a new approach. And that partnership, again, based on trust, based on full disclosure and information, based on shared decision-making, and based on a holistic commitment to a patient-centered approach, where you're not just looking at the medical encounter, but you have to look at the patient's entire situation, their family situation, their living situation, if you're going to focus on health, not just health care. So that's ambitious. That's very ambitious. But the places that are starting to do this seem to be showing some real results. But it's not a simple thing to reorient an entire profession. And it's not a simple thing to reorient consumers and patients. So I think having this work is going to involve all of the things that we've talked about, but it's also going to involve just one-on-one relationship building between a care team, between the patients and their families, and that's the hardest work of all.
Great, thank you. So the challenge of engaging consumers on ACOs, Deborah, Jay just cast you a challenge, I think. How are we going to, maybe we've chosen the wrong name, and you know, mea culpa to those of us who were all in the room when it came up. But how should we be engaging consumers? How should CMS be thinking over the next month or two and rolling out the educational program? Change the name? You know, what has your research been showing you?
Well, what I understand Jay meaning when he says on ACOs as opposed to in ACOs is really the piece of engagement I referred to as involving the consumer advocacy community in the policy development and the shaping and the designing and redesigning of our delivery system. And I have to give this administration very high marks for the work that it's been doing to do that. Don Berwick is as good as his word. His focus on patients extends to a pretty open door policy at CMS and the Innovation Center, and an anxiousness to hear what it is the consumer community thinks needs to be built into these models. So on that front, I believe we have an open administration, and I think we have an increasingly active consumer community that's educated and sophisticated and wanting to engage on these issues. I also want to say that in what I think of as the quality measurement enterprise writ large, of which I think the Engelberg Center and the Quality Alliance Steering Committee that Mark co-chairs, groups like the National Quality Forum and the National Priorities Partnership, these are groups, multi-stakeholder groups that have been grappling with quality and delivery system reform. They have all welcomed consumer participation and made that a central element of the way they build consensus. So in my mind, working together in these multi-stakeholder venues, both with private sector healthcare providers as well as with the public sector, is the way to get the consumer community engaged on ECOs. And for the consumer community, I don't think you have to change the name. What we call it to the real world, to ordinary people, that's where we probably need to do something.
Yeah, no, a couple of focus groups that we ran with another organization had people thinking about accountants when they thought we used the term ACO. So, you know, we may want to, and whether our Tucson ACO really wants to be called a taco is an open question. Well. But when we get to engaging consumers in ACOs, I mean, Deborah, you had raised the question about how to notify consumers. And I would say that our California pilots are pretty far along in a model that has joint notification of those who fully attributed model, no lock in. This is their PPO health plan. Joint notification through a letter that goes to the patients from the ACO and from the payer, with a follow-up letter that's going to come from the primary care physician, the development of a website that gives them tools to get access to care, and fully describe that you're not locked in to go anywhere, but we're trying to build these resources for you, including a care navigator for the complex patient. So it is trying to, the way they're approaching it is recognizing this, you know, this isn't going to be about taking things away from people. The way this is going to be attractive is by making it attractive, that this is providing additional support. I'm not sure how far we're getting, and, you know, there probably is much more in terms of consumer engagement on governance committees that can be on governance boards. Aren't there patients involved in many of the activities at Kaiser, you know, as in the safety work, or having a patient tell a story that motivates it? I'm trying to remember the things I've heard.
We do that, but as I said, I think the primary thing is that, you know, we're all patients. Everyone on the governing board, all the doctors' families are patients. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a circular question as to who's a consumer. We're the consumers of our own product. I'd just like to make one other comment. I agree completely with what Deborah said about this question of organized consumer representatives and understanding and participating in the creation of ACOs. But I do think that there's another issue there that Don touched on in his comments, which is perhaps more fundamental. It goes back to this question of, you know, what do people hear when they hear the word ACO, or in this case, isn't there in the concept of an ACO, certainly I think that's what Don said, the notion that there's something in this about managing the future costs of healthcare? As best I can tell, everybody who writes about it says this is not just about quality. It is about quality, but it's also about trying to deal with the problem the country has in terms of escalating healthcare costs. And if that's in there, as it is, how do we help people understand that, and help people understand it in the way that Don explained it today, which is this is fundamentally about how to reduce the cost of healthcare, or at least the escalation, the continued increases in the cost of healthcare in the United States, by making care better, by making it more accessible, by making it more efficient in the right way, and focusing in the way that Dr. Gawande suggested in his article, focusing on those individuals where a little bit of investment provides a great deal of return, not just in improvement in their health, but improvement in the overall cost. And I'm afraid unless we find a way of conceptualizing that and engaging people more broadly on that fundamental notion, then this whole idea could be hijacked purposely or inadvertently and made to look like things in the past that people were suspicious of. I hope that's not the case.
John?
Yeah, I think most consumers
are anxious to avoid a repeat of the managed care backlash. And so presenting this primarily as cost savings is not the way to do it, although that should be a goal. But from an individual patient point of view, keeping you out of the hospital and providing more services at home is very attractive. And, of course, that's the key to the cost containment anyway. So, you know, one of the tensions, though, with this model is that it's going to be hospital-based, it seems, often. And so, you know, how committed are hospitals to lowering their volume?
It comes to that great question of authenticity. It comes to the question of authenticity. And performance measures, perhaps. Deborah?
Yeah, I think John is absolutely right. You can't lead with the discussion of the cost-cutting goals of this model. But when we've talked with patients, and we've done a lot of message research to figure out how to engage people in this conversation, there are lots of strands you can pick up on and get them to this place. So, for example, people say to us, you know, I want a doctor or a clinician who really knows me as a person, and knows enough about me that their recommendations will make sense in my particular life. In that statement, there are a lot of things. There's this idea that they know that the same thing doesn't necessarily work for every patient, and that gets directly to the more is always better mindset. There's a recognition that when a doctor doesn't really know you and instead you're seeing 14 different specialists and everybody's looking at a different body part, they talk about the fact that that leads to misdiagnoses, duplicate tests and procedures. They talk about it in terms of their own money, co-pays wasted. They talk about it in terms of burden. Talk to caregivers about the burden of unnecessary procedures and duplicate tests. They talk about the idea of wanting their doctors to talk to each other. That may be the sine qua non most often complaint that we hear, that one doctor doesn't talk to another doctor, and as a result, I have to make so many more visits, and they don't reconcile my medications. I think I'm taking more medications than I need to take. So I think that there are ways to get this frame so that people understand the reduction of waste and duplication and burden and even cost.
Yeah. And Elliot, if I was going to name this, I'd name it coordinated care organizations. I think accountable is great for policy, but it's not for patients.
Absolutely. No, I think I wouldn't. I'm with you.
I see another article coming.
Oh, no. We've written enough. It's time to get going, as Don said. So one of the big issues that's been talked about a lot is this issue of, you know, patient attribution, assignment, lock-in. You know, some people are saying we ought to allow patients to choose as opposed to informally attributing them. Some thoughts on that? I mean, we've got some pilot sites that are doing some interesting things, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about benefit attribution versus sign-up and how we should be thinking about that.
Well, if we're really going to be patient-focused, that means the patient gets to make some decisions. And so, therefore, this needs to be a voluntary situation. And one thing I think that distinguishes it from capitated models is the ability to choose to go outside if needed.
Absolutely.
But, of course, what we all want is for it to be so attractive to the patient that they buy into it in a committed way. But, again, that's part of the shared decision-making. That really does need to be voluntary. Or I do think we risk reenacting the kind of backlash that we're all trying to avoid.
But interesting, the attribution models, for instance, Advocate in Chicago is using a monthly attribution model to let patients and primary care physicians know who we think your primary care physician is, so that we can reach out and take care of you. I mean, the notion that primary care physicians would actually be told who they think their patients are is I think a pretty promising step toward from where we were, which was 20 years ago or 5 years ago when I was last practicing. You know, I knew the patients I'd seen, but I wasn't sure whether they thought of me as their primary care physician or not, or whether there was any recognition of who was responsible or who the other physicians were. So even the attribution can be useful in that sense. What do you think, how would you, I'll do one more question and we'll open it up for some questions. So get your sharpen your pencils, think about what you want to want to ask us, what do you think about the performance measurement? It's a question to you, Deborah. If we start with strong, the next version of CAPS, the ACO CAPS, is that going to be, sufficient to hold these, if we're doing it on the organization or on every physician, is that going to be sufficient, or what? How would you think about that?
Well, I think patient experience is going to be critical to telling us whether or not we're improving care for patients. I think we need a number of vehicles to do that. I think you need validated, standardized survey instruments, and I would like to see us develop an ACO appropriate CAPS tool.
CCO,
coordinated care organization. So I'd like to see us develop an adapted version for use in this model. And I think we need to be able to trend, compare, and give that information back to patients and give that information back to the providers of care. Mm-hmm. But I also think there's a need for real-time qualitative feedback as well. You know, Jay talked about a system that provides feedback much more rapidly to your clinicians than...
Are you transparent on that? Do you publish that, each individual's scores? Or is it shared within the physicians?
It's shared among the physicians. They know, but we don't know. We don't mail it out.
We'll work on it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is you need both. You need the standardized information that becomes available to the public, but to the patients. But you also need the kind of real time feedback, and that can be more qualitative feedback. It can be more flexibly obtained. There are lots of different models for doing that. But that's the information that can be used to help practitioners immediately improve their practice, and that's the kind of information that actually doctors and patients could engage around. So I feel like we need both of those. And I also feel like we need to push ourselves toward measures of patient-reported functional status.
Yeah, I would, we at Dartmouth have been doing this for 10 years in Jim Weinstein Spine Center, where, patients complete a tablet or an online survey that about their functional status. It's presented at the time of the visit with and talked about with the clinician, and then reassessed, and the patients love it because they actually see something about themselves.
Right.
The providers initially said, I don't want that, and after about 3 months with it, they said, I'm never going back.
Right.
And that those kinds of information systems, as the Beacon program rolls out and the HIT gets more advanced, are going to be possible, and accelerate the improvement and the sense of engagement, I think.
Just a little footnote on this. I think we should measure patient experience, health outcomes, functional status. But it's also important to show patients that we're actually going to use this data.
That's the key.
And have demonstrated commitment to be responsive. Otherwise, you lose credibility and you lose that authenticity.
Yep.
And anecdotally, I think we hear all the time that the places that are doing this, the patient satisfaction goes way up, but the clinician satisfaction goes way up. People get excited, and then actually they're proselytizing the merits of involving their patients in the care process.
Yeah, there are some technical issues that need to be overcome to make it accessible everywhere, but I think those are increasingly, those barriers are falling as meaningful use extends this. Well, let's open this up for about 10 minutes of questions from the audience. We have mics wandering around. Let me see if I can. Let's have the folks with mics come forward. Let me see. Why don't I start from the front here? I'm afraid I don't know everybody's names. Mark probably does, but I'm just from the sticks of Vermont.
Hi.
Introduce yourself if you could, and then and then ask your question.
Tip Ghosh from Strategic Health Resources. To echo Dr. Borwick's comments this morning, there's provisions in the Affordable Care Act specifically on reduction of healthcare disparities. So as the movement for accountable care grows, and you're talking about consumer engagement, especially for chronic conditions, it's really important to understand not only diversity, but the diverse needs of patients. So if you can comment, Deborah and others, on how does reduction of healthcare disparities for heart failure, for diabetes, which are key conditions.
Well, one of the things I said in my opening comments was that all of our measurement work needs to be stratified so that we can monitor the impact on different populations. That's a given. The patient engagement work, the interaction with the care community, needs to be culturally sensitive. It needs to be sensitive to health literacy levels. Needs to be sensitive to disabilities. And I think we have a long way to go, and this has to extend at every step in the process, from how we notify people, those materials have to be culturally appropriate, to actually the patient engagement tools that we use, whether it's shared decision-making tools or whether it's self-management support tools. All of those have to be made culturally appropriate.
If I could just add, I think one of the keys will be hiring supportive staff from the communities who can relate directly to the entire diversity of the population served.
I think there are also, you know, structural and investment issues here because, you know, the question is where in this ACO transformation is the role for DSH hospitals, federally qualified health centers, and the like, where a fair portion of this care is delivered. And I think I know there's a lot of activity going on trying to think about that, but I don't know necessarily that anybody has a clear notion of where the money is going to come from, where the expertise is going to come from, and the like. And I think in the absence of that, you know, we could end up having this very valuable idea serve only to further widen the gulf of care that exists that we have.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to say. The article that John referred to by Atul Gawande, Hotspotters, talks about the Camden experience and the team that they use. And it's very interesting because in addition to the physician and the nurse practitioner and the social worker, they have a whole slew of health coaches that are modeled after the Promotora model. And these are folks from the community who actually speak the language of the people in the community, understand them, and actually have more success in helping to change health behavior than any of the other players in that team.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes to a couple of things. One is about new payment models that enable those practitioners to be supported, and you know, and then some tools that let them actually do the work, like you know, as Jeff's article. I mean, the article about Jeff and also his. Much of his stuff, I believe, is available online in terms of the Medicaid ACO work that he's developed in New Jersey. It's really quite a promising. It'll also come back to the risk adjustment issue that we'll talk about in the next panel, which is, in addition to a new payment model, you need to be able to make sure you're not disadvantaging systems that are taking care of the highest need populations. And I'm pretty confident CMMI will be some of that, I would hope, that early rollout of innovations in ACO models over the next year, the vanguard will include some vanguards that are dealing with dual eligibles and dealing with those populations. Let's have a couple more questions, Cindy.
Garrett Gustafsson, former VA DOD CMS. Well, first, a big loud applause for Don and what he's doing up there. I mean, the words he was using, the phrase of the vision, very key to where we want to try and go, where CMS needs to go as an organization. Don was right in one thing, the focus needs to be on health, and I think that's one thing we're missing by the ACO concept is we're on the care side, not on the health status, functional status side of the equation. But there's another part where words are very important, and a word we still don't get quite right. You've used consumer, you've used patient, yeah. You may use member, you may use beneficiary, whatever. What we came to both in DOD and VA much more was the term person, it's about people. Because what you get into in the patient side is you get to them too late. It's after they show up and they're sick. If you look at the consumer, it kind of gives us mistaken notion about what their role is. If you talk to people, they understand what people are and what persons are, American Association retired, et cetera, and so forth there. So the question, I think, really comes back to there. If we really believe that it's about people before they are patients, when they are patients, after they are patients, and it's not just about consuming health, but it's about behavior, prevention, and those things. How do we get the right terms in here, and how do we get them to be consistently used?
Great, great question. I would say that I think the measure we're missing in terms of both ACOs, medical home, is a measure of health risk, you know, that could, you know, capture the burden of avoidable morbidity and mortality that a population has so that we could hold medical homes, ACOs, accountable for improving the health of those that they're through measurement. And I think there's some promising work on the horizon that should be coming out in a couple of months. Other questions? Yeah, we might as well march. Oops, Cindy, I'm letting you control this mic since I can't see all the way back. Yes.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. The problem that I see is that in order to have a patient-centered decision-making or shared decision-making and the trust that's so important, that requires time. And what we are judged by, in addition to all these other, these new things, our success, outcomes, we're judged by productivity. That's what it's called inside the ACO. Even at Kaiser, it used to be 12 minutes a visit, 5 patients an hour. Now you're down to 20 minutes a visit, 3 patients an hour. And in addition, we have to return all the phone calls and the emails. Subspecialists don't have to do any of this, or at least they have more time and less to do and less supervision. It's the primary care physicians at the bottom who are supporting the whole superstructure. What is happening is that medical students looking at the situation are voting with their feet and becoming procedural subspecialists, which is where the big cost driver is. You haven't mentioned anything about any of this.
All right, well, let me say a couple things, and then, or actually, Jay, I'll let you. Do you want to answer that?
I think it's an excellent point. There are many things that could derail all these good ideas that we've talked about today. We talked about consumer attitudes, perhaps being one. Another one is just what you mentioned, which is that at least with respect to adult primary care, the pipeline is running dry. And it's running dry because of payment disparities or inequities or whatever you want to call that, which have developed over 20 or 30 years. But also, as you point out, because the workload of particularly internists and family medicine physicians has become greater as the average age of the population they're caring for has gone up. Many physicians now see patients every day in their 90s and some patients in their 100s with multiple problems. And then, although electronic technology, such as I described earlier, is wonderful, it can also be cumbersome, and take more time at least. So we have a problem in the country, which is if we're going to have this model, we've got to have and get to what I talked about, which is 98% linkage between patients and their physicians. We've got to have the physicians to do that, or we're going to have to transform primary care away from physicians to other caregivers or the like. And I think the solution for that is very complicated. It's going to involve, I think, some significant changes in how physicians are paid, perhaps starting with Medicare. And I think it's going to have to involve, changes in practice style and perhaps more team-based care and other things that will, in fact, make the life of future primary care physicians tolerable and satisfying. And we're not anywhere near there yet.
Although I think there certainly are glimmers, I'd add two things. One is there are glimmers of hope from the redesign, the experience of primary care physicians, whether it's practicing at Geisinger or Group Health, their medical home pilots, where they were transformed in ways that led to much higher levels of patient satisfaction. And you talk to Jeff Brenner about how excited he is about his work and his colleagues when they're in that kind of team model of care. I think the second thing I would, just from my Dartmouth Atlas perspective, would say that there's no correlation between supply and this perception of scarcity or workload. I think it's about, you know, places with many, many more primary care physicians, the physicians feel just as overworked and have just as disorganized care as where there are fewer primary care physicians. So it's not probably about how many. I think it's about how we work. It's about how we organize care, how we deliver care, new models of care that probably offer some promise. And maybe the new payment models in these coordinated care organizations will enable us to support primary care more adequately. And I think we're starting to see that. We should now wrap up this panel. I will say that there is a 15-minute break. I want to thank our panelists for joining me up here and for their spectacular comments. Thank you all.